Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
When Shorts Were Short only concerns itself with what was actually a very narrow window in football history when teams wore, well, short shorts, the podcast will only cover football from 1954 when Umbro made their first England kit with shorter shorts, a design that was widespread within English football by the mid-50s, to 1992 when short shorts were all but finished as Umbro's baggy shorts for Tottenham's new kit ahead of the 91 FA Cup final quickly caught on. I'm Daniel Ruiz Tyson. This is When Shorts Were Short. If the shorts weren't short, we don't talk about it. Stuart Horsfield is the latest of these Football Times podcasters' elite squad to join the show. Actually, I'm never sure what the right term for these guys is. Podcasters, pundits, analysts, or perhaps thinkers, because these guys really go in deep on their football, which is what we like our guests to do here on When Shorts Were Short. He's certainly a writer, I know that, because he's on to talk about his late 2020 book, 1982 Brazil, the glorious failure, the day football died, that unforgettable side in the yellow canary shirts, or canary yellow, that wowed the world just over four decades ago now. And curiously, Stuart's book was the first to be written on this team that somehow failed to lift the World Cup in the searing heat of Spain 82. As someone very familiar with both his writing and work on these Football Times, I've long thought Stuart to be quite unconventional in his thoughts on the game. And his answer to my opening question in this week's episode is wonderfully unorthodox. The evening of the 14th of June 1982, a Monday, the stadium Ramon Sanchez Pizjuan in Seville. This was probably when that World Cup really got underway here in the UK, the night before the champions Argentina. I always preferred it when the champions actually opened the tournament. I can't remember when that was changed. I think it was around 2002, wasn't it? Possibly 2002. I might have that right. Or was it 2006? There was a time when I would have known the answer to that. It was certainly still in operation in France 98, because Brazil, who were the holders, opened that tournament with, a narrow win over Scotland. So the night before, champions Argentina had fallen to a shock 1-0 defeat to Belgium in the opening game of the tournament, a match where, owing to the Falklands conflict, it wasn't actually shown here. All we saw was a clip on the news on the Sunday night, and it really was just a clip. Extraordinary when you think about it now. And that would have probably remained the case with all Argentina games had the Falklands conflict not been resolved before the end of that tournament. There was Poland versus Italy kicking off in the late afternoon on the 14th of June. That was just as kids were getting home from school. I remember my dad missing most of that match because of work. But on the 14th of June, in the evening, Argentine forces surrendered and the British flag was raised on West Falkland to signal the end of the conflict. News, if I remember rightly, it broke either just before Brazil and the Soviet Union took to the field, and this game was on the BBC, on BBC One that night, or it broke during the game itself. I can't recall which. I have a hunch it was before the game. Either way, for anyone watching that match, I don't think too many minds were on the Falklands once the game was underway, because we were watching something extraordinary unfold. And up on the Yorkshire coast in Scarborough, a small boy was watching the game too. And while up and down the country, boys spent the rest of the summer pretending to be Zico, Adair, Socrates and co. Or if you were weird like me, maybe Leandro, one of the best right backs I've ever seen to this day. For this boy in Scarborough, it went a little deeper. That match against the Soviets left him bewitched by the men in yellow, and Telly Santana's men would continue to thrill, their fragility at the back increasingly evident as the tournament progressed. A complicated format involving a second group stage shouldn't have been too difficult to navigate, but instead Brazil would find themselves in arguably the group of death to top all groups of death. The semi-finals would elude them, perhaps adding to the myth that had quickly built up around that team, and Brazil 82 would go the same way as Hungary 54 and the Netherlands 20 years later, forever doomed to be labelled as one of, if not the greatest, of teams never to win the World Cup. And for that young boy in Scarborough, the memory of the summer of 82 would never leave him. This is Stuart Horsfield.
I want to start by asking about your relationship with football at the time the 82 World Cup arrives, because I'm fascinated that, as you put it in the book, your love of the game had no patriarchal influence. You grew up in a single parent family. Your mum wasn't interested in football. Your granddad, who was, lived very far away. And you're right that this meant you were able to create the relationship that you wanted to with the game, which is unusual and intriguing. And also, to this day, I think you don't support anyone, which I think gives you a very unusual and refreshing take on the game. Can you expand on this a little bit, please?
You're right. I don't support a team. I still don't support a team. And it very much affords me, like you say, a somewhat unique perspective, shall we say, amongst friends and peers and people that I interact with. I found very few people like myself who just love the game without that almost tribalistic affiliation to a side. I'll chat about my sort of love of the game and where that came from in a moment. But yeah, certainly my not supporting a team, it doesn't bother me that often, but there are occasions when I will listen to friends or others or even on the television, and you see the incredible highs that football fans can experience. And, you know, and they could be 40, 50, 60 years in the making, and they may only ever get it once. And for all that my non-partisan enjoyment of the game, I know I will never experience that incredible high that some football fans must achieve or crave or search for, and when it arrives must be indescribable. And likewise, I will never feel the tremendous lows, the heartbreak, the devastation, although at 10 years old in the book it certainly felt like it, but I am aware that I probably sit in a very broad band of moderate highs and moderate lows, and the emotion of it sort of sits in the middle. But what it does do is it allows me to appreciate so much that the game has to offer, so much that some people will miss out on because of this partisan attitude, I guess, that comes with supporting a team. I always look for the beauty in the game, no matter who's playing or who it is. I can always find the joy in the game. And I think, and that's probably where my reward for this rather strange relationship with the game probably comes from. That the fact that I get to maybe see things that not everybody will see, depending on who they support, that I can watch a game and find and be able to find the joy or the highs or whatever it is, or the beauty in it that some people will miss. And that's probably where I get lucky that maybe fans of clubs perhaps don't get. But yeah, in terms of my relationship with the game, it very much was very organic. Like you said at the beginning, you know, no patriarchal influence at all, apart from my granddad. I was just allowed to develop this love of the game. And a lot of it came from playing the game. A lot of it was, you know, constantly, if I could be out playing football, I would be out playing football. That was the thing. And then from there, the joy of watching it sort of came from that, obviously by the television. And again, you know, as people of our age will know, there wasn't a lot of live football. There wasn't a lot of highlights. So when you did get a game, you soaked it in and you wanted to absorb every moment of whatever live football was available. But again, where I grew up in Scarborough, they weren't a league side. They were a decent non-league side, but there was certainly no real football culture within the town, you know, than if you're in Leeds or Sheffield or Liverpool or Manchester. You know, that football culture didn't exist in the town. So again, you know, there wasn't even an influence of a club or the pull of a club that was there either. It was just very much I loved playing the game and couldn't get enough of playing the game. And then from there, I enjoyed reading about the game, you know, on the back page of the newspapers. I enjoyed watching the game when there was a chance to watch it. But I was very, very much left to my own devices to find that relationship. And I can remember trying to support teams that sort of almost forced, yes, I will be a Liverpool fan, or yes, I will be a Tottenham fan. They've won the FA Cup twice in a row. You just can't do it. It's pointless. And from there, I sort of quite quickly and quite early reconciled that I would just enjoy watching whoever was playing. I would maybe have a preferred team who would win whatever game it was. Players were important to me, you know, watching certain players as opposed to the teams. And yeah, as much as I tried to force it, I reconciled quite early with not having a team and the fact that I never would.
And you spent nearly four decades waiting for someone to write a book on the Brazil 82 team. Were you surprised no one had written a book on the team before?
I was very surprised. And then when I started, I really panicked that someone might, that someone was. So from patiently waiting for an awful long time to panicking and praying that nobody would, it was quite a switch in emotions. But yes, I was surprised. And it's probably only sort of in the last, probably, well, I suppose with the advent of social media, to be fair, with social media, you know, and social media has many, many pros and many cons, but certainly for football fans, it unites people, it allows for discussion, it allows for memories, you know, and all of those things. And as I got involved, certainly relatively late in terms of age, with social media, my interaction with social media, my interaction with football writers, lovers of football, you know, the fraternity, if you like, that is out there, you know, seems to have got bigger and bigger. And as I got to learn about it and explore what social media could offer in terms of football, that's when it really became a surprise, because the team was always spoken about, always revered or always ridiculed. People always will have an opinion on this team. You know, I'm not saying that they're polarizing, but, you know, it's very much they should have, and this is the reason why, or they're the greatest that never, you know, that never won it, but this is the reason why. And, you know, so that they're a real sort of pinch point and focus for the sort of World Cup in the 1980s, and certainly for Brazilian football as well. They're very much a focal point, and as time has passed, you know, that reputation has just become more and more mythical as time has gone on. And, you know, like I said, to me, it was crying out for a book, or I could never understand why one hadn't been written, because of the myth that surrounded it and the almost cult following that they have since and subsequently sort of gained.
What I really took from this book was I'd never fully considered, okay, I knew the Brazil 74, they fascinated me, because within the space of 4 years after Mexico, they became this cynical team that weren't convinced they could cope with the power of the Europeans. 78 is a bit of a mystery to me, and your book helped me understand 78 a bit better. But what your book gave me was an appreciation of the drift in that decade from the beautiful game and that great 58 to 70 era. And it was clear that it was important to understand this before you could understand how that 82 team came about. Was this something that you realized you had to tackle before writing the book? Or was it something that you realized once you started writing the book?
No, it was definitely something that I realized needed to happen. My knowledge of the 74 World Cup, for whatever reason, I have no affinity with it whatsoever. I have no love of it, no real, obviously I don't have recollection by age, but I have no reference points. You know, I'm aware of the Dutch and, you know, I'm saying my really good friend Gabby, who's also just written a book very similar to this about that Dutch side. I am aware of the 74 World Cup, but I have no real awareness or in-depth, I had no awareness or in-depth knowledge of it. And writing a book about the 82 side was always going to be difficult in that you are trying to get across essentially five games is what you're trying to do. You're trying to write a book about five games of football. And so I realized I needed more than just that. But if it was not going to just be a magazine or a pamphlet, and it was actually going to be a book. And so for me, it almost became a journey of self-learning, if you want, which sounds quite grand, but it was, because like you say, I didn't understand how they went from 70 to 82. I wasn't aware of the journey. Now, what I knew was, is that nobody really spoke about the 74 Brazilian side. Nobody really spoke about the 78 Brazilian side in terms of how 70 and 82 were spoken about. So something must have happened. Something must have occurred. Something must have, I don't know, evolved, changed, whatever it was in Brazilian football. And it was the bit I was dreading about the book. I was really, because it was going to have to be a lot of self-teaching, research, understanding of what happened. Could I understand what happened? Would I get it once I'd sort of read about it? Would I be able to relate it to 82 from 70? You know, would I have enough in me to be able to form that bridge? But then once I got into it, once I left 70 alone, and, you know, like I say, I only wanted to touch briefly on 70. Once I left it, once I left 70 and started to get into this research, you know, the social aspects, the cultural aspects, the dictatorship, the retirement of Pelé, these are all things that I just never considered. And once they had my full time and attention, it almost became an obsession and a fascination. Those almost missing, the sort of missing 12 years or missing two World Cup tournaments, it became almost an absolute passion to find out as much as I could as to what happened. So yeah, it was definitely something that I was aware of I would need to do, but I was dreading it at the same time.
It throws up a fascinating character in Captain Claudio Coutinho, completely new to me. Before we go on to him, just give us a brief summary, your opinion on what impact the military dictatorship might have had on the national team. I mean, I know in 70 there was pressure on Saldana, Zagallo's predecessor, to pick Pelé, and I think he excluded him from the team and was therefore replaced shortly before the 70 World Cup. But beyond that, what was the military dictatorship having a regular impact on the team and the kind of football it played?
It was very, I mean, obviously, the dictatorship, Brazil won the World Cup in 62, and so they're world champions, and I think I'm right, the dictatorship is 64. So it doesn't have, it can't have any association with those two, 58 and 62. It has no association with those World Cup victories. 66, Brazil are kicked out literally in the group stages. They're physically kicked out. So the first opportunity that the dictatorship have to, for want of a better word, ride on the back of what is Brazilian football success and global, apparent global dominance, in a very popular sport, it doesn't exist. It's, you know, it's almost embarrassment. It's, you know, it has no real impact in terms of as a source of propaganda for the dictatorship. It doesn't stop them getting involved in 70. And in 70, they begin to understand the importance of football. They begin to understand the link between public satisfaction and success as a nation in football. But in terms of being able to utilize it, like say, use it for propaganda. That there'd never really been an opportunity because of what happened in 66. So once 70 arrives and there's this possibility and this, you know, this chance, and that the World Cup comes back to, I suppose, Latin America rather than South America when it goes to Mexico. And, you know, there becomes a real opportunity and, you know, real potential for, once again, for Brazilian success. You know, we discussed the merits of Pelé and his selection, but certainly as a side, clearly it's an incredibly talented side. And this is where the dictatorships start to understand the influence. They start to understand the potential that this football team has in order to appease the public, which is part of, sort of makes their job, I guess, for want of a better word, makes their job a lot easier. Once Brazil win that World Cup in 1970 and win it, I mean, I love the 82 side, but even I've got to say the Brazil 70 side, when people talk about them being the greatest side, they back it up with that they also won it. So, you know, there can be no argument as to whether or not they are the greatest side to win a World Cup. And obviously from there, the dictatorship is very much, is looking to seek influence, is looking to gain influence and does gain influence, looks to sit itself within positions of power, positions of influence, where it can influence the national team. Again, obviously what happens in 74 and 78 is that then doesn't play out in the way that they would like to. It's almost... the dictatorship get to benefit from that ultimate performance, that ultimate tournament, that those ultimate images from that first colour World Cup. But either side of that, it's 66, it's 74, 78. Really, there is only one tournament where that influence and that the power that football can bring to unite a nation, the dictatorship really only get one go at it across... realistically, five World Cup tournaments. They only ever get to experience it once. But that once is 1970, and that once sits right in the heart of when that dictatorship was probably at its strongest and most influential. And so with that comes the perfect propaganda off the back of that World Cup win.
I'm trying to think of a British equivalent of Captain Claudio Coutinho, and the only one I can come up with is Bertie Mee's move from physio to Arsenal manager. That's as close as I can get. Who was Captain Claudio Coutinho, and how does he go from his original position to actually managing the side in 78? It's incredible.
He's an incredible man. And again, would make a wonderful book, whether there is an English language book about him, I'm not sure, but and this is why I was dreading this period of time and this research, but the more I got into it and the more characters like Saldanha as well, the more these characters came out, it was so rich. So Coutinho is actually, works for the military. He's very much into physical preparation. He goes to NASA in the States, where he learns about physical conditioning for astronauts. He even works with, I forgot his name, Cooper. I've forgotten his first name, I apologize.
That's
who,
okay.
Creates the Cooper run, or the fitness test that is the Cooper run. And so he absorbs all of this physical conditioning knowledge. When Brazil looked to go to Mexico and the World Cup's played at altitude, the military, this is where the military are now starting to have an influence. And they place Coutinho as the physical conditioner for the Brazilian national side. And they start 3 months prior to Mexico, and they are in incredible physical condition. And the belief was that, all things being equal, Brazil were technically the best side at the 1970 World Cup. If they could be the strongest and the fittest, bearing in mind where it was being played, they would win the World Cup. So the technical elements had been taken care of. It was all about physical preparation. And Coutinho was placed by the military. It's not a sort of a square peg in a round hole. You know, he was at the forefront of physical conditioning. You know, he traveled the world looking at training methods, fitness testing. You know, he was the right person to go. But then from there, he then stays in and around the national team. He's He's the coach of the. He takes them to the Olympics in 76, and it's almost by association. So once he's in with the Brazilian national side, once his influence is there, and clearly his influence was there for all to see in 1970 with Brazil. It's a ridiculous amount of goals that are scored in the last half an hour of that tournament, purely down to their physical condition. So he stays in and around, and eventually it gets to 78, and they're looking for a manager, and he's been in and around the national team for nearly 8 years, has been a part of a successful World Cup winning backroom staff, and eventually is given the job of the national team. And it's an incredible journey, but it's one of those where if you look at it in isolation, you would really question why he's been given the job. How does this happen? How does the physical trainer or the physical conditioner from the 1970 World Cup end up as the national team manager, you know, in 1978? But once you look at the story, you look at the murky world of dictatorships and influence and Brazil's sort of penchant for changing managers at national team level on a whim, you eventually end up with, you know, if you wait long enough and if you're patient, your time will come. If you can stay with the national team for long enough and bear an influence, your time will come. And sure enough, his time came in 1978.
They almost win it. That's the thing. They come closer than 82. They do far better than 74. They finished third in 78. You mentioned the controversy over the Argentina-Peru game. I think most would agree there was something fishy there, and yet 78 is almost forgotten.
It is, and it's a strange one because, you know, they're the only side that don't lose a game at the 78 World Cup, and yet, you know, they don't win it, which obviously the logistics of FIFA and how they organise their tournaments, and that's fine. You know, teams can afford to lose a game perhaps and still win a major international tournament. But certainly, you know, I think there's a quote that they, you know, Coutinho thought that they were the moral victors, which is great, but it doesn't give you the trophy. So, you know, they were a good side. They were effective. There were signs of what was to come in 82. It was almost 70 was such a high and 74 was such a crushing low in terms of performance, in terms of relationships with the nation, with the fans. And 78, it starts to come back up again, that will eventually reach this sort of emotional, almost spiritual high in 82. But in 78, it's on this upward curve. It's still not enough to convince a lot of the fans. There's a lot of, and I as much as I tried, I couldn't get to the bottom. There's a lot of hearsay that he sacked during the tournament, and Admiral Nunes is making the decisions, and then he's reinstated. And there's a lot of...
Admiral Nunes is the head of the CBD.
That's right. He again, dictatorship, self-appointed, essentially what would be the head of the FA. You know, he's a self-appointed head of the Brazilian Football Federation.
The self-appointing is a system that clearly worked for them.
It clearly is. And you know, when he's literally on the bench in major tournaments, you know, questions have to be asked. And, you know, clearly, as much as Coutinho was a military man, he certainly wasn't, in terms of hierarchy, you know, was nowhere near the influence that Nunes had in terms of bridging dictatorship, you know, and the national team. But Coutinho, he gets them playing certainly more attractive football than in 74. He gets them, like we say, to within a controversial 6-0 scoreline of the final. But it's not enough, and you know Brazil finished third, and you know it's deemed as failure. But like I said, 78 is such a fascinating World Cup tournament where so much happens, not just for Brazil but for Argentina. Just it is just an incredibly fascinating tournament with so much happening that the performance of Brazil is almost just another, you know, just another sideline in the narrative that is probably the most conspiracy theory laden World Cup. It's a World Cup that has so many facets, and that's probably partly why Brazil's performance gets lost as such compared to, you know, finishing third and coming so close and not losing a game. You know, it's, you know, even the goal that's ruled out by Clive Thomas, you know, the corner's come across and Zico's headed it and he blows the whistle, you know, just as the ball's connected with his head. And there's so many things that happen in that World Cup, but ultimately that World Cup is all about Argentina. And again, dictatorships and what goes on there, and that 6-0 victory against Peru, that, you know, the story that is Brazil is lost in such a complex narrative.
And Brazil reach, still under Coutinho, they reached the semi-finals of the Copa America the following year. It's a two-legged semi-final against Paraguay. Zico suspended for the first leg. They go out. You write in the book that around this time, the dictatorship starting to release its vice-like grip on the country. You talk about things feeling a bit more free. There's a sense the country's starting to recover its cultural identity, and you speak of the national team undergoing this, as you put it, symbiotic metamorphosis. Were the people craving better football, or had they become accustomed to what was being served up during the 70s that wasn't quite matching what they'd seen at the start of the decade?
I think even, obviously, thank God I've never lived under a dictatorship, but I can't obviously even begin to imagine how oppressive it must be. And, you know, people must cling to cultural moments, cultural affiliations. You know, they must just cling to things that sort of symbolize who they are, you know, despite the repression, despite the severity of the lives they had to lead. You know, people must just cling to what makes them Brazilian, what makes them Argentinian, what makes them, you know, whoever the nation is. And obviously with Brazil, football is such an expression of Brazilian society, of Brazilian culture. It's, you know, it's one of their ways that they demonstrate to the world who they are, what they are, what they're like as a nation, what they're like as a people. You know, it's a real form of overt and outward looking expression to the world of this is who we are. And in 70, it's distilled perfectly. You know, it's a perfect distillation of what Brazil is as a nation, who the Brazilian people are. 74 and 78, you know, it's almost the complete opposite. And again, this is me, but I think partly the images that I associate with 74 and 78 is rain, clouds, wet pitches. You know, both of those World Cups for me just seem so dour and so grey. And Brazil almost get lost in that. And it's almost like they can't force their way sort of above what is this dull tournament, you know, these dull images, these dull pictures that are coming through. And then, like we say, as we get to 82, you know, the dictatorship are starting to release the grip. People are starting to feel that they can speak more freely. People are starting to feel that they can express themselves. And that self-expression then manifests itself in this side that Telly Santana starts to put together. And it's, to me, the 82 side was the only way they could ever play in terms of what Brazil needed as a nation, what the Brazilian public needed as a nation. I don't think it would have mattered who the players were, who the manager was. It was almost like the nation demanded a return to Brazilian heritage, Brazilian style, Brazilian culture. And it was, I don't think it would have mattered who it was. It's almost like it was a demand, an air of inevitability because of what was happening in the country. It was just an extension that carried on onto the football arena.
So, as you say there, Telly Santana takes over. He takes over in June 1980. Why was he the man to take Brazil forward?
He was very much his own man. And I think that a lot of that gets misrepresented. He was very much, you know, this Brazil side are very much seen as sort of all draws and no trousers, whatever the saying is, you know, all style, no substance. But they weren't, you know, there was a lot of substance to the side. And Santana was incredibly intelligent, but also had a real unshakable faith in the way the game should be played. It was, you know, he bowed to nobody, literally nobody, as to how the game should be played, how his team should play, how he wants his players to play. And that sort of almost demand for aesthetics first, that demand of it wasn't win at all costs for him. It was all about performance. It was about art. It was about demonstrating that what is essentially the beautiful game. And they were the things that he prioritized. And like we say, at that time, that was what the Brazilian people wanted. They wanted a side that they could relate to. They wanted a side that they would be proud to call their own, that would represent them coming out of what had been 15 years of dictatorship, 15 years of repression. You know, that they wanted a side that would put beauty, Brazilian culture, Brazilian heritage, you know, they wanted a side that would put all of that first before the results. And in Tele Santana, that is exactly who they got. They got the perfect person to almost represent the Brazilian people on the football pitch. And whether you look, whether it's in the stars, however you want to look at it, whether it's, well, with the benefit of hindsight, it just worked or what, it doesn't matter. It was the perfect man with the perfect belief and philosophy to represent what the Brazilian people wanted at that World Cup from their national side.
Also, around this time, I mean, up to this point, Brazilian football was regionalized by state owing to just how ridiculously huge the country was. But they changed that, don't they, around this time? They come up, I think, with the first national championship. Does that help the national team? Is that the idea behind this?
It's about increasing the professionalism of the game in Brazil. When you start to write a book and you think, I'll write about this. I love this team. I know the players. I know the scores. I know the games inside out. This will be easy. And then you learn things, and then you look at how the domestic football works in Brazil and you think, that's complicated. Then you look at how Brazilian football worked in the 1970s and 1980s and you think, oh my word, how on earth did this work? And it's, like you said, the sheer geography of the nation dictated the way the game had to be played. You know, it had to be regionalized. But eventually logistics improve. Obviously the Copa Libertadores has a massive influence on this, in that they are after the best South American side from Brazil to play in their competition. And so you need to find a way of having your representative in the Copa Libertadores. So it does improve the professionalism of the game. It certainly gives a better understanding of players' levels of ability. If you're playing in a regional league and you are the best player in that regional league, that's okay. But how do you know that that player is the best player in Brazil? And that was always the problem. But once the National League comes into effect and becomes established, you get a real idea of where the talent lies in Brazilian football. And I think it's Yuka Kofori who I spoke to about the book, and he sort of summed it up perfectly. That side realistically was just filled with the best players from each of the sides that dominated their regional leagues and competed on a national level. It was almost like it was just handpicked the best players. It didn't matter where they were from. It didn't matter whether they'd played together before. It didn't matter, you know, realistically, whether it would upset the system or the formation. Santana just picked the best players. And it sort of proved, in essence, that actually the best Brazilian players were spread out across these various and different regional leagues. And you only got that because they played in the National League. And it almost emphasized that actually, yeah, these are the best players in Brazil. And they happen to play for lots of different teams.
That was something I was going to ask you later. May as well ask you now. I mean, this show, its window of history that it covers is a very narrow one. When shorts were short, 1954 to 1992. But you just said there, and you say it in the book, that Santana always picked his best players when they were available. And we had this in the last, 15, 20 years with Ericsson. It was something that was leveled at him as a criticism. The England team, he would pick the best players rather than the best team. But Santana was doing this 20, 30 years earlier, and it almost worked for Brazil, didn't it?
It did almost work. And it's, I suppose, if you look at Ericsson, it was the eternal problem of Gerrard and Lampard, Scholes and Beckham, you know, four ridiculously generate once in a generation of talent. You know, how do you play all four of them? Now, Santana did exactly the same. You're right. He picked the best players. What he didn't do was then try and play them in a midfield four. What he allowed them to do, and this was really important, he trusted his players. He trusted them not only to play the game how he demanded it was played, but he trusted them to play in a way on the pitch that was incredibly fluid, incredibly dynamic, and would bring out the best in each other. And I think that was the difference between how Santana made it work or how Santana allowed it to work, rather than Ericsson was almost caught, as you say, between the devil and the deep blue sea. It was, well, it's 4-4-2. They're my four best midfielders. But instead of changing his formation and looking at how you could accommodate those players in a different way, he just had his formation and then put his four best players in. Santana picked his best players and almost said, right, you're my best players, you go play. Now, however that formation works, that's up to you. And again, in the book, so many people have theorized and hypothesized as to what formation he played. And you could pick any number of formations looking at how they lined up, other than the goalkeeper, two centre halves, and Serginho. Pretty much everybody played wherever they felt like it more often than not, which again, people will argue that is what does for them ultimately. But what it also does is allow a brand of football, like I say, and this is why I wrote it, it allows for a brand of football that I had certainly never seen before, ever. And even now, look to, and it'll never be replicated because the game's moved on, but you know, they played in a way, they played in a style, they played in a, for playing the game, it's probably the best way I can describe it. It was a World Cup, but it was just play for the joy of playing, and from there is where the results will take us. And that's what Santana allowed. He said, you're my best 11, so you're on the pitch, however it's now on you to make this work. And he trusted his players implicitly. And that's probably why they got so close to success from what actually seems like quite a fortuitous way of doing it, of just picking players and putting them on the grass. It was that absolute faith and belief that he had in his players, and his players had in him as well.
At the back end of 1980, early 81, there's a tournament that's always fascinated me, disregarded and overlooked by this country, as you know, as is their history. Anything like this, they will say, No, we're not playing. All, I think, at the time, six former world champions, World Cup winners, were invited to this tournament. England decided they couldn't go because of a fixture pile-up. I'm sure other countries might have had similar issues as well. So the Dutch replace England, and Brazil make the final under Santana. And I vaguely remember, I mean, I know that they lost to their old foes, Uruguay. I think there was a moat around the stadium, if I remember rightly. I'd never seen that before. Though they lose, that strikes me as a small staging post in their development, their re-emergence under Santana, quiet re-emergence, maybe.
And that's the mini World Cup. It's a fascinating piece of, like you say, football history that you find it, and some people will say, no, I had no idea that existed. And some people say, yes, I know all about this. How do you not know about it? And it is again, one of those fascinating elements that come from research that is required to write a book. But yeah, you're right. It was past World Cup winners, you know, and so with that come the Dutch who replace England. Germany are there, Uruguay, Argentina are there. You know, this Italy, it's an incredibly, it is the best of the best of the traditional powerhouses. Even now, you know, they are the nations that will always be at the late stages of an international tournament. Not, they won't all be there, but there will always be an Italy or a Germany. There will always be an Argentina or a Brazil. You know, it's those sort of six nations that take part at that time. You know, they were the dominant force. They were the global force of international football. And Brazil navigate that combination of European physicality, which is what the problem was in 74, where they try to be overtly physical based on what happens in 66. In 78, they try to almost mix that that physicality with, I suppose, the skill and the athleticism or the control and technique that, that Brazil are known for. But in the Mini World Cup, what they do is they show that actually we are technically good. It doesn't matter what physicality you bring, we are technically that much better, that we will overcome whatever you can throw at us physically. And obviously with the South American sides, yes, Uruguay, you know, do beat them in the final, but they show at that competition that they have almost everything in place to be incredibly successful. And they do eventually go into that tournament as clear favourites.
I was lucky enough to see Brazil when they went to Wembley in May 81. My recollections are vague, wow, and the book actually fills in those gaps. I'll tell you the three things I remember. My dad bought a ticket off a tout. That's how we got in. Somehow he got me in as well, lied about my age, and I got in. I remember England played fairly well, but my dad, as I've told listeners a few times, was a keen amateur goalkeeper, obsessed with keepers, and there was this stereotype thought about Brazilian keepers, probably up until Taffarel, that they weren't up to much. And Perez that night played fairly well. I think in your book you say he was a bit fortuitous a few times, but my dad was talking about him. But also for that next year, just talking about, you know, just looking forward to seeing Brazil play because of what we'd seen that night. And my recollections mainly come through my dad and reading your pages on that game, filling a few gaps. But more than that, what I remember from that time, as you say, they went on a spring tour as part of a European spring tour. The fact that they beat West Germany 2-1, who were walking through their World Cup qualifying group at that time, they were European champions. They ultimately, despite reaching the World Cup final in 82, they disappointed at that World Cup, but they were certainly Europe's strongest country. And the Brazilians just turn up and win 2-1. They beat them, I think, the following year as well in the run-up to the 82 World Cup. And as you say, by the time they get to the World Cup, they're clear favourites.
That mini tour, so, you know, like you say, it's England, it's West Germany, it's France in 9 days. And that really sets the scene. That was sort of almost the ultimate confirmation for Tele Santana that what his team were about, how he wanted them to play, was more than capable of dealing with anything that Europe had at that time to throw at them. And, you know, you look at France and you look at the French team that play in that 82 World Cup, you know, and there, you know, that momentous semi-final with West Germany, you know, that is a great, great French side that eventually goes on in 84 to win the European Championships. You know, like you say, you know, West Germany, the dominant force, France, the emerging force, England, we always think we're better than we are, but it's England at Wembley and all that goes with that. But yeah, those 9 days really not only cement Europe's perspective on who the favourites are, but it also cements Santana's and the Brazilian public's opinion of who the favourites are as well. You know, there is this, you know, it's almost not up for discussion or negotiation when you watch the full games again and you get that commentary and co-commentary and you get the bits that you sort of don't remember, or when you're watching highlights on YouTube, you don't get that. When you watch the full 90 minutes and you listen to what's said in the quieter moments of the game, and, you know, Brazil were, you know, everybody was in awe of them leading up to that tournament. South America were in awe of them. Europe were in awe of them. It was merely a formality that this side would just, it was just going to be a procession onto the final and onto win it, especially with it being in Spain. The heat that comes with it was not even going to be a factor or an issue. You know, it was just, it was almost an air of inevitability that this side were building and building and building towards something incredible. The something incredible was there. It just didn't last and didn't sort of see out the entire tournament. But yeah, going into it, everybody was talking about them. The press. I talked to Patrick Barkley, and, you know, he was saying that prior to the tournament, you know, that everybody was after Brazil's group. Everybody wanted to be reporting on the Brazilian teams. Everybody wanted to just be a part of what Santana created. They wanted to be a part of what the players were producing and the feel that came with it. It was, and I think this is why they have this such a mythical sort of status. You know, they were so inoffensive and so glorious that everybody just wanted to be a part of it. You know, there was nobody who wanted to see them, apart from the Italians, there was nobody who wanted to see them, who wanted to see them fail. Everybody wanted them to go out and do what we all thought they were going to do.
And the man you become obsessed by, Zico, who's, I think, 29 at the time of the tournament, he's already come to the attention of English football fans December 81. And this is a game that you can find anything on YouTube nowadays, but I have to say it's one of my go-to football clips on YouTube. What he does to what was, I mean, they were on the downward slide, Liverpool, and perhaps they'd taken the World Club Championship as an excuse to go out drinking in Tokyo, but they weren't going to win against that team no matter what. I mean, what Zico does that day in Tokyo, the clips that you see of his football, it's just an extraordinary individual performance. And I think, you know, he ends up being injured at the World Cup, crude challenge, I think, from Passarella, but clearly he's the one to watch. But there's also players that we didn't know about before. I mean, Falcao, the importance of Falcao is clear from your book. One of only two Brazilian players who's based abroad. For 2 years, Santana can barely select him because Roma won't release him, but he's always saving that space for him. And that you tell us that doesn't cause any resentment within the squad.
It's part of what, you know, when you talk about Santana and Eriksen and, you know, and the sort of the club rivalries and the cliques that allegedly existed, you know, in England national team up until present day with Gareth Southgate. But what Santana managed to do with that squad was, bar a couple who, as the tournament progresses, you know, there's a little bit of ill feeling between some of the centre-halves, but everybody bought into the ultimate goal. Everybody bought into winning the World Cup. Everybody bought into not only winning the World Cup, but winning it in a certain style. And that was the important thing. And the players understood that to win it and to play it in that style, you needed certain players to be playing. And everybody was aware, like you say, Falcao, you know, Roma don't release him. It's, you know, it's 2 years practically without playing for the national team. I think it's about April time when he finally managed, April of 82, where he finally manages to get, you know, to join them. But it's like I say, it's how Santana did it. You know, people have this perception that this side are very soft. Santana is tactically naive, you know, and that's why they don't. That's why they don't go on to be successful. But actually, Santana was incredible strength of mind, was not for changing, was not swayed. He knew who he needed to play the way he wanted his team to play. He knew who he needed to make his team the best version of his team. And he stuck with it. And he waited. And the players, you know, the strength of Santana's character is that the players bought into it without discussion, without recrimination. It was, he had created this perfect sort of environment that everybody, again, wanted to be a part of and understood what was required and the sacrifices that would have to be made if they were going to be successful. He gets it wrong in the first game, you know, with selecting De Sea, who is the other non-Brazilian not playing in Brazil domestic football. You know, he gets that selection wrong, but he, you know, that side, those 11 players that play in the remaining four games, you know, they play for 15 minutes in a game against Republic of Ireland. And that midfield five play only once together for 15 minutes in the lead up to that World Cup. And yet, from the Scotland game onwards, it's the same 11. It's that same midfield five. And it looks like they've been together a lifetime when really they're thrown together for the Scotland game. And that's how they stay. And you know, history sort of can rattle those names off. But actually, those names only ever play together four times and 15 minutes in the entire history of the game. And people don't realize that it's literally a microcosm in time that those 11 players play together at the same time on the same pitch for Brazil. And people forget that. But Santana had created an environment that it was okay. Players were okay. Squad players were okay. The starting 11 were okay. Everybody bought into why it would end up being like that. And again, it's strength of character of Santana that quite possibly gets overlooked because of the style of football that they played.
Still to come on When Shorts Were Short.
The complexity with which FIFA created those second groups took an awful lot of understanding. And what I still don't understand, because obviously some groups, like Brazil, have one group winner and two runners-up in them, whereas other groups had two group winners and one runner-up. So, you know, it was always going to be slightly loaded or in favour of certain of certain teams. So Brazil really were the only group winners in their group. It just so happened that Argentina and Italy were the two runners-up that dropped into that group.
Half time. You may be able to hear it in my voice, but I haven't really recovered from last week's rundown state. And while this week I've had fewer gigs, I've still had enough commitments that were going to make getting a show out this week very difficult. But for the first time, I was lucky enough to have someone else step in to edit the show. A big thank you to Dave Bowler, who did a brilliant job. It's rare for me to enjoy listening back to an episode when I'm editing it, because as I said last week, it's such a labor-intensive process. The focus is on making sure the levels are okay, that you're editing out any filler words and any repetition. It's such a slow process. It takes me about 3 to 4 days to get through it. But Dave sent his edit through. The audio was all balanced out with presets. I just had to listen back to it, break it up in the middle to insert the sting as I do each week. And by the way, the reason there's always a 3-second pause midway through each episode, which you've probably picked up on, is because you're meant to leave that in case the show ever gets out of time. I've never actually listened to an episode of When Shorts Were Short once it's on whatever podcast platform, so I do wonder if they automatically carry ads. I'm that much of a pedant or anal, whichever you prefer to use, that I don't want to listen to an episode, partly because I don't want to skew the download figures, even if it's just by one. That's the kind of guy I am. Having Dave edit this week's episode just made life and my week that much easier, and I did need an easier week. It saved me 3 days of work this week, so thank you to Dave. Give him a follow on Twitter, at Magic of FA Cup. Next week, if I'm feeling better, I'll get back to the slog of producing an episode of this show. As I say every week, any small indie show does need reviews to survive. So please, if you enjoy the podcast, do rate, review and subscribe on your chosen platform provider. We're still way short of the kind of reviews and number of reviews needed to really get the show some serious traction. It is the only way that long-term a show like this survives. Good reviews increase visibility. It draws in a new audience and the show grows. As I said a couple of shows back, I will need to cancel the Twitter premium I took out back in December to get the show back on its feet. It may have helped. It certainly did on Twitter in terms of visibility, but I'm not convinced it's helped downloads too much. So this means from early April, the podcast and any episode links will be far less visible on your timeline. And I'll keep an eye out on what that does to downloads, if anything. I mean, if you've now discovered the show, you're not going to be relying on social media to know the latest episode is out. I'm hopeful that is the case. I'm just letting you know again that I will still be there. The show will still be there. It's just you may not see it. And some breaking news relevant to this show this afternoon. I'm recording this intro on the Thursday. Is that Elon Musk has announced yet more changes to Twitter / X. So watch this space. So that's this week's admin over. Now time for the second half. Let's get back to Stuart Horsfield.
Over the years, people have made a fair bit out of a 21-year-old Kareka dropping out of the squad just a couple of weeks before the tournament started. Now, we'll remember the world-class talent he was in 86 and 90. In 82, he's only 21. Was that a significant loss to the team, or was he just too raw for that World Cup, regardless of the injury?
Oh, you see, and again, this is why this team is so fascinating. He was very much of the style of that side, even though he was only 21. You know, he was very much, you could see him fitting in, playing. You could see him finding himself in goal scoring positions. You could certainly see him having opportunities to score. Now, whether he was more clinical goal scorer as Serginho was, who actually was, you know, his record is very, very good and was very good in domestic football in Brazil. But obviously his physicality made him stand out. You know, he was the square peg in the round hole. And you're right, Careca is not 86 Careca, it's not Napoli Careca. It's a very young, inexperienced Careca who's, I think, played two or three times and that's it. But I think he would have been good enough purely because of the players that would have surrounded him. I think Serginho's problem was he was good enough. He just played the game in a different way. Careca, I think, was good enough and played the game in the right way. And I think when he would have been surrounded by Eder, Socrates, Zico, Falcao, Cerezo, Junior, he almost couldn't fail to have succeeded. I would have played him. But not that counts for anything in history. But yeah, I would have picked him over Serginho, without a doubt. I can see what Serginho brought. I still think Careca was a better option, and I think would have been another reliable avenue for goals.
Well, we finally get to the World Cup itself, and I apologise for the hour-long preamble. I just think it's an immense book, and it really, I think, just as important as the 82 World Cup is how they got there, the journey of that team in style and personalities involved, but also the aftermath, because it's just 82 is almost an anomaly, really, even in our lifetime, and we'll come to that. Yeah. In the end, we come first of all to the game that changed your young life, the Soviet Union. I think Cerezo is missing. He's suspended for that game.
That's right.
How does that game change your appreciation, understanding of football? And did Brazil get off lightly against the Soviet Union, maybe?
Yes. Let's get that first. Brazil were lucky to win that game. They were lucky to win that game. I am very blinkered with this side, but as we can see, I can see the joy and I can see the game clearly. And looking back, yes, Brazil were lucky to get a win. What changed in 82? We don't see the opening game, Argentina-Belgium, because of the Falklands conflict. So we don't see that game. It's then Italy. Now, I want to say versus Peru. It's Italy.
It's Poland. I think it's Poland.
Poland. And it's 0-0. And it's 0-0. And it's during the day, it's 0-0. It's not great, but as a 10-year-old, it's a game of football that's live, so that's okay. The third game is Brazil-Soviet Union, and everything changes. It's under the lights. It's so difficult to explain if you didn't live it as a 10-year-old. It's under the lights. It's the noise, I think, is probably the first thing that hits you. It doesn't sound like a game of football, and that's the only way I can sort of describe it. It doesn't, you know, I've watched at the time, it was FA Cup finals, it was league games, it was the odd European Cup final, but they had a sound, a very similar sound. But Brazil, the Brazilian fans, the crowd, the heat, the lights, the way they played, although, you know, they weren't great in that opening game, but you still saw step overs, you still saw passes with the outside of the right foot. You still saw Serginho sort of take a through ball on the outside of his left foot. You know, without it hitting the floor, he catches it on the volley and it's 6 inches over the bar. And, you know, if that had gone in, everything, you know, his whole career would have changed, the whole percentage, you know, for the sake of 6 inches. But they were doing things that you just don't see. I didn't see in English football, other than arguably Glenn Hoddle at the time. But you didn't see it, and it was done so regularly in the game that the step overs were done, the back heels. I mean, Socrates would back heel it for no reason. There wouldn't even be anybody around him and he'd still back heel it. And it still is everything that I love with the game. I like to be entertained, and it was pure entertainment. It was pure theater, the whole game. And it's because it was so multi-sensory, I think somebody asked me a while ago about it. You know, they said, how would you describe it? And it's multi-sensory. It was the sound, you know, and it was the vision. it wasn't just a one-dimensional image on the screen. I know this sounds quite grand and quite...
No, I have to say, I read that, and I think you're speaking for our generation. I think you made me understand what I was watching that day. It was everything that you said it was. I'd not seen that. I mean, my recollections of seeing them live, I didn't know what I was seeing. But after that, I'd built something up in my head. So I expected something, but I didn't expect something so different, so beautiful. But I didn't understand it. I didn't understand what I was watching.
And that was it. Yeah, you didn't. And like I say, it was like nothing I'd ever seen. And I was all for England winning the World Cup. You know, I wanted to watch England. That's where I was just watching the games as they were coming along. But I can just, obviously the two goals then, you know, speak for themselves, and certainly the second goal. And the second goal for me, if anybody, I'm quite fortunate in that I can pinpoint the very moment that I truly, truly fell in love with football, or truly, truly understood the beauty of the game. And it is that second goal, and it is the dummy from Falcao. It's that moment when nobody actually touches the ball, that just it's what created my, I suppose, obsession with this side. It's what cemented and created my love of football, but my love of a certain type of football. You know, I can appreciate athleticism, I can appreciate a good tackle, I can appreciate all of that, but that dummy, that pure nonchalance from Falcao, but you don't know that as a 10-year-old. You just want to go out and try it. The next day, you spend a lifetime letting the ball run through your legs on the off chance that it would work. But it was that moment. And the goal is stunning, you know, by a day. You know, there's still so much more to do, but it is purely the not even looking, the casual indifference that comes with such a beautiful moment. And that moment is where my obsession with the game, and my obsession with this Brazil side, and my obsession with the way the game should be played, comes from that single moment in football history. And that's, like I said, that's probably the greatest compliment I can pay that side.
Who'd fallen a goal down to that infamous Perez error. And I was probably going to go down that cliched route of, you know, Perez and Serginho, what were they doing in that team? But your defense of the pair, we've already heard you talk about what Serginho offered the team, but in the book, you also mount quite a stern defense of Perez. And I thought this guy could get OJ off. It's because it's quite convincing. I mean, was he the best Brazilian keeper at that time? Leão still around?
Yeah, Leão was still around. And, you know, there's a lot of questions as to why he wasn't played. But, and again, talk to you about Santana and his almost obstinate, not for changing, not for turning. And he picked Perez, and Perez never let him down as much as I've been able to get hold of video footage. And, you know, like I said, there's the double penalty save in that game against West Germany in 81 on that mini tour where he saves twice from Breitner. You know, there's penalty, he saves it, it's retaken, and he saves that one as well. You know, and he doesn't do anything to not be selected, if that makes sense. And because Santana was so loyal and so single-minded in what he believed was right, that he believed Perez was his best goalkeeper. And so that was it. That was what he did. That was who he played. And you can mount the same argument for Socrates, for Zico, for Adair. You know, he believed that they were the best, and performance justifies that. He believed that Perez was the best. And the Soviet Union goal probably questions that. And unfortunately, it's the first game, it's the first half, it's the favourites against the Soviet Union. So again, it's so magnified. The error is so magnified and so intensified because of it being 0-0, because it's the first game that Brazil played, because it's the first half, because it puts them behind. You know, if he makes the same error 4-0 up against Scotland or 4-1 up against Scotland, it doesn't become quite the moment. But because of when it happens, it becomes a real issue. And he also, and this is a horrible thing to say, he also suffers because of his physical appearance. He doesn't look like an athlete. He doesn't look like a goalkeeper, but he does go on to make, and again, this is the beauty of getting access to full game recordings, he does make good saves in later games. You know, he's beaten by an incredible goal by David Neary. He doesn't concede against New Zealand, which probably shouldn't. He makes really good saves against Argentina. Again, Argentina's goal in that 3-1 victory is an incredible goal, very similar to Neary's, but probably further out, probably even further into the top corner. Up and from that moment in the first half against the Soviet Union, he doesn't really put a foot wrong until you get to the Italy game.
The Scotland game, 4-1, they win 4-1, glorious goals, though somewhat undermined aesthetically by Scotland's Alan Ruff not diving for a couple of goals. This is a bugbear of mine from old football. The 70, 74 and 78 World Cup finals, the actual finals themselves have goals where the keeper doesn't dive, which almost to me cheapens a goal. It's like you're playing out on the streets with your friends and the kid currently in goal doesn't like playing in goal, so makes no effort. And I think Willie Miller, Miller you speak to, mentions Alan Ruff didn't like to expend energy diving for something if he wasn't going to get it. They're still extraordinary goals, but if the keeper had dived on a couple of those, I think it would have taken him to an even greater level.
I agree. It's funny because you're right. I spoke to Willie Miller and you know, he was really dry sense of humour. You know, and he said, you know, I looked at the free kick and I was in the wall and I watched it and I knew it was going in. And as I was going in, I was thinking, at least dive. He said, I can remember thinking, do yourself a favour and at least dive.
And I think that the same happened in 78 against Peru from a free kick as well.
That's exactly. I mean, Alan Ruff, I really wanted to speak to Alan Ruff, but I just, for whatever reason, couldn't get a hold of him, or whether he knew I was trying to get a hold of him. I don't want to speak to him. I don't know. But you're right. The reaction of a goalkeeper can intensify the beauty of a goal, or it can diminish a goal, or it can almost accentuate how perfect, you know, a goal is. I mean, Alan Ruff just sort of turns 90 degrees to have a little look as to where Zico's free kick's gone. And it's like, what are you thinking? I mean, I'll never be a professional goalkeeper, but you do find yourself thinking, what are you thinking here? How have you not just thrown yourself at it?
I suppose the only defence I can find for him is that Dasayev in the first game, who I thought at that time was possibly the best keeper in the world. I mean, he's left rooted to the spot. I think, was it for the second Brazilian game?
Second Adair's goal,
I mean, and Dasayev was no mug. So they had a habit of doing that to the keepers. Did Brazil, I think Santana says, we cannot play better than we did in the second half. Did Brazil peak in that Scotland game, do you think?
I think the Argentina game is the best team performance for all the things that this side get criticised with and gets thrown at them for not being able to defend or tactically naive. The Argentina game, if you watch the full 90 minutes, it kind of puts that to bed for me. The Scotland game are real moments, like you say, almost unforgettable, not necessarily life-changing moments, but, you know, Adair's goal is, you know, it's incredibly, you know, it's so sublime. It's so, you know, that when you look at the first goal against the Soviet Union, the power that it's hit with, the power of the free kick against Argentina that hits the bar, and yet he produces absolute touch from the edge of the area to chip Alan Ruff inside the 18-yard box, which is incredibly difficult to do, but it's done to perfection. And this is a really good Scotland side in terms of personnel that are playing. So I think if the Soviet Union were a good side, but I think if you looked player for player, the Scottish side were probably the best team other than Brazil in that group in terms of squad experience, ability. And Brazil made them look not even average in that second half. You know, they were, you know, William Miller said, we were just hanging on. And a lot of the time we couldn't even do that. You know, it was just a merry-go-round for them.
The final group game for Brazil in Group 6 is that 4-0 win over New Zealand, you know, expected. Now, there's a problem here for Brazil. I have to say, I liked the format of the 74, 78, 82 World Cups with two group stages because I like that league element. I've said it before here, it's that last man standing element. Where I think 82 maybe went up another level is it reintroduced semifinals for the first time since 70. I think that was a good move. The problem for Brazil is while they're wowing the world, Argentina and Italy are struggling. So we end up with, you know, the cliched group of death, but I don't think there's ever been a deadlier group of death. It's a ridiculous group for the best team in that tournament to end up in. Everyone else, I mean, I think England, West Germany, Spain as a group comes close, but West Germany, as we've said, they were hit and miss. Spain was struggling. England were doing fairly well, but Brazil, Italy, Argentina, I mean, that's just a ridiculous group.
It is. And all things being equal, it should have been Brazil, Belgium and Poland. It all things being equal is how, you know, if Italy were going to run out group winners, if Argentina were to run out group winners, but they don't. Poland win Italy's group and Belgium win Argentina's group. So in the grand scheme of things, it should have been, like I said, Brazil, Belgium and Poland should have been in that group. But because Italy are so poor, so, so poor, and because Argentina suffer that opening game defeat to Belgium, it ends up being, like we're saying, the ultimate sort of group of death. The complexity with which FIFA created those second groups took an awful lot of understanding. And what I still don't understand, because obviously some groups, like Brazil, have one group winner and two runners-up in them, whereas other groups had two group winners and one runner-up. So, you know, it was always going to be slightly loaded or in favour of certain teams. So Brazil really were the only group winners in their group. It just so happened that Argentina and Italy were the two runners-up that dropped into that group. And it did generate the ultimate group of death. Like you say, you know, England and West Germany and Spain is quite the group as well. But then you had, I think, the Soviet Union, Poland and Northern Ireland. You know, you had some really weak groups.
Yeah.
You know, there were two really heavily loaded groups and then two sort of far weaker groups. But
Italy have beaten Argentina 2-1 in that group's first game. Then Brazil run up a fairly comfortable 3-1 win over Argentina, the game in which Maradona is famously sent off. You mentioned Ramon Diaz's spectacular goal. I think it's in the final minute of that game. Again, I mean, we've seen them go a goal down to both the Soviet Union and Scotland. We've seen them coasting at 3-0 against Argentina, but they kind of switch off. There's a habit of switching off. Was that weakness just there throughout?
You see, it's really strange. If you look at the goals they conceded, I mean, I don't claim to be the foremost expert on this team or their games, but I've watched a lot of their games over and over again. The first goal by the Soviet Union, Andrei Bahl, I think it is, you know, like we say, it's that shot from 30 yards. It's just a mishandle by Perez, which you would like to think that even 99 times out of 100 would just go straight into his hands and the game would play on. David Neri's goal is incredible. And I don't think there's a goalkeeper who would have saved that goal. The goal against Argentina, and I know I'm going to sound like an advocate for this side and that they can do no wrong, but that will change in the Italy bit. But against Argentina, you talked about Maradona getting sent off, and it's Batista who's fouled. You know, Maradona kicks out in the groin. And from that moment, Batista comes off, gets treatment, comes back on. The minute he comes back on, the ball's played to him, and he's not really had a chance to sort of recover from his injury, and he goes to turn, and Diaz is in and has taken the ball off his feet, and he's hit the shot from the edge of the area. And again, doesn't matter who the goalkeeper is, you know, they wouldn't have saved it. It's to me, they are one incredible goal by Neri, one goal that was Batista just not being ready to go back on the pitch. Why they gave him it, I've no idea. And then Andre Barles was a 1 in 100 times that would go in. So teams did get chances against them. They did. Argentina didn't, apart from that Diaz goal. You know, you watch the Argentina game and it's almost a perfect performance defensively and offensively. New Zealand doesn't count. I don't mean to be disrespectful to the New Zealanders, but they were never going to cause problems. Scotland do for the first 20, 30 minutes, the Soviet Union do, cause them probably more trouble than anybody else does. Like I said, people level a lot of either criticism or statements or observations, and you can see why they do. And going into writing the book, from memory, I thought they were brilliant, but quite susceptible. Then when you really study the games, really watch them in detail, you see so many things that you'd forgotten about or missed or didn't remember or didn't realise or weren't tactically aware enough at 10 to understand what was happening. They were susceptible, mainly because of the two fullbacks, is probably why they were so susceptible to conceding. But the goals they conceded didn't really come from that susceptibility. That comes in the Italy game, where the susceptibility was absolutely magnified, you know, catastrophically.
And they only needed a draw, but they're chasing the game effectively from the beginning. You grabbed a remarkable coup for the book in tracking down Abraham Klein, the referee who reffed that game. I'll let you tell the story, your interview with him in a moment, but you mentioned that he refereed the Brazil-England game in 1970, his first World Cup match. Then he'd officiated in the 78 third place playoff as well between Brazil and Italy. Was that run in the line or as a ref? Because I know they used to do
as the
both.
Referee.
Okay.
Yeah, as the referee.
So in 82, he's back again. I can't recall a ref with such longevity at the highest level. That's four World Cups at least.
I mean, it's funny because when I first came up with the idea of writing the book, and you think, who would I like to speak to? And you know, you come with all these names, and I became almost obsessed with Abraham Klein because, like me, well, not like me as it turns out, but like me, he would see it as a neutral. He would be the perfect person to have an opinion on that game. You know, he would see it as a neutral. He would call it exactly how he saw it. And he was closer than anybody. You know, he got closer to that game than anybody else on the planet. And I became obsessed with wanting to speak to him.
Was it easy to track him down?
It became really easy. It was Rob Smythe who'd contacted me or I'd contacted him about something. Oh, it was about Abraham Klein, because he'd written a piece from on The Guardian. He'd been to stay with him for a week in Israel. And he said, oh, you know, you're writing a book about Brazil 82. I interviewed the referee. And from there, I was like, oh my God, do you have any contact details? And he was like, yeah, he's a really nice guy. Let me check that I can pass them on. So he contacted Abraham, who was, passed them on, gave them to me. And I can remember I rang from the car park at work just before I went into work, sort of introduced who I was and sort of tentatively, you know, could I speak to you? And he was he is such a great guy. We still message and chat probably on a weekly basis even now. So he is as fascinating as you sort of hoped he would be. You know, sometimes you think, oh, I hope it's all that, you know, I hope his memory's as good as it can be. I hope he has great anecdotes, but it even exceeds all the things you could ever possibly hope he could. Every time he speaks to me, does he have a new story about something, some game? And I could listen to him for hours.
And he wasn't happy to get the game, was he?
No, he was. He thought because the way they worked it out as to who plays, you know, as to who plays who, and he wanted the Brazil Argentina game because he thought that would be the group decider. He thought that would be the game. He knew he didn't have the first game, so he hoped that he would get the Brazil Argentina game, and he didn't get that one either, and he was. And he was really disappointed because he knew he wouldn't get the semifinals. He knew he was running the line in the final, and that if the final went to a replay, he would be the referee for it. So that was taken care of. The World Cup final was taken care of. This was going to be his last game in the middle officiating unless the World Cup final goes to a replay. And Italy had been so poor, so, so poor in the group phase, you know, qualifying over Cameroon by virtue of scoring a single goal. You know, we talk about teams going home undefeated. You know, Cameroon don't lose in the H2 World Cup, but end up going home because Italy scored one more goal than them. And, you know, and he just thought, the same as everybody else, that this was going to be a procession. Brazil would win. That would be his World Cup sort of refereeing done and dusted. And that was it. And it was really interesting. He said, you know, he said as soon as Paolo Rossi scored, he said, I knew that this was going to be an iconic game, a game for the ages, a game where I would need to be absolutely on the money, on my metal from minute one. He said, you could just, I just knew it. He said, I just knew within 5 minutes, this was going to be something different. And obviously, sure enough, it's probably one of the most famous World Cup games of all time.
Why couldn't that Brazil team settle for a 2-2? Did they just not have that in them?
No, and I got hold of a lot of transcribed interviews by that squad. And it's funny because, you know, talked about, you know, the squad buying into what Santana had said and buying into the philosophy and buying into how they played. And they'd been behind against the Soviet Union. They'd been behind against Scotland. They'd scored far more goals than them and won. They'd outscored, obviously, everybody that they'd played. They had come from behind twice to win. They didn't see any reason why this would be any different. Yes, it became knockout football at that point. It was a de facto quarterfinal. But Santana had instilled it. So it was so embedded in the psyche of that side, so embedded in the attacking players, in the forward players, in the flair players, that they just couldn't do it. They couldn't do what was required. It was almost like their bodies or their brains just wouldn't let them do what was required to see out the draw. You know, just after they score, Leandro's having a shot from 35 yards, and you know, everybody's piling forward, and it's the centre half, Lazinho, who he was the only voice from these sort of interviews who really questioned and really was really upset, perhaps, with the arrogance of the side. He's the only person who ever really mentioned the team being arrogant. Everybody else, it was, that's just what we do. It's how we play. We always win. Why would we change that? Why would we hope, if we score again, you know, if they've got to get two, why wouldn't we go and do that? Because that's how we play. That's how we played this whole tournament. It's why we've scored 15 goals. You know, they didn't really see a need to change the way they played because it had been so successful. And nobody saw that as an arrogance. They just saw it as, but this is what we do. It was almost infantile in the thinking that, well, this is what we do. This is how we play. This is how we win. This is how the script goes. This is just another version. And yeah, Lazinho was the only player really who touched on and discussed and resented perhaps the arrogance of some of the players, resented the lack of enforcement from Santana and from the sidelines about playing deeper, you know, not going forward in quite the same way. You know, he was very resentful that didn't come from the sidelines. He was resentful that it didn't come from Socrates and, you know, Zico and some of the senior players. He was the one, sort of the one voice that questioned the arrogance with which they played that game in. But everybody else was very phlegmatic about it, very Brazilian about it, very, well, that's the way we played and that's how we thought we would get through.
And Santana steps down after the World Cup. What I find interesting about this, unusually, I think, for a Brazil team that had gone out early from a World Cup, the 82 side certainly initially was celebrated back in Brazil, I think. Any other Brazil team before or since, I'm guessing, well, I know since, they just would have been destroyed on their return, but initially, they're almost welcomed back as heroes, and it takes a while for the media maybe to start looking into who's going to be the scapegoats.
It's almost like a sleight of hand, I suppose, for the Brazilian public. It's, you know, it's this Brazil side are everything they want the Brazilian team to be, and probably even more. You know, they embody everything. It's, you know, like I say, you know, the title of the book, Glorious Failure. The football is so glorious, and yet it's failure. But it was done in such a way that it almost got missed. Well, hang on a minute. You didn't actually even make the semi-finals. You didn't even come close to winning it. Such was the beauty, or such was the sleight of hand with the way they played, that it actually took a while for recrimination to kick in. But the Brazilian public you know, hadn't had a team like this since 1970. They were, you know, they valued that representation of themselves almost higher than actually winning the tournament. You know, it was on a global stage. It was, this is us. This is who Brazil are. This is, you know, you see the fans in the stands and in the stadiums at that World Cup. You know, it's a real true representation of Brazil and Brazilian culture. And I think that actually became more important, that Brazil's identity was reaffirmed through that football team than perhaps winning it. And, you know, as we, you know, we talk about 94, you know, that it's so un-Brazilian. It doesn't represent the Brazilian public. Yes, they win the World Cup, but it doesn't represent who Brazil are as a nation, whereas this side absolutely do that. And I think that's why the recrimination takes time to happen.
Between 82 and 86, Brazil sacked three managers before Santana returned. And I remember, and, you know, we're the same age, and Brazil 82, something extraordinary. I remember their first game at Mexico 86 very well, because coming from a Spanish family, that was a big game in our house. I think it was a Sunday night, Brazil-Spain. And I remember being so disappointed by Brazil that night, not understanding what had happened to them. Obviously, the team are 4 years older. I think Socrates might have been struggling with injury. I know, yeah. Zico was.
Yeah.
But throughout that World Cup, I mean, they make the quarterfinals. They go out to France in an epic clash. Arguably, both teams pass their best. I mean, France,
yeah,
probably the stronger side. But in our lifetime, since 82, I'm trying to think, maybe only the 98 side in glimpses came close to 82. You know, peak Ronaldo, young Ronaldo, best player in the world before that fit on the day of the World Cup final. Is that right? And does that therefore make what we saw in 82 just an anomaly?
Yeah, yes. You're right. When you actually look at it, and again, you can call it sleight of hand, you look at Brazil 70 and Brazil 82, and such is the magnitude and intensity of those performances that you almost get hoodwinked into thinking that that's how Brazil play all the time. And even now, at every World Cup, when Brazil take the pitch, I can't help but think something's going to happen. You can't help it. Something is going to happen. Something is going to be. And it always disappoints. It always disappoints. And, it can never possibly live up to, certainly can't live up to 1970. Never lives up to 82. You're right, you know, 98, 2002, when they win it, there are glimpses, there are moments of Brazilian magic, but the game has changed so much in terms of, you know, the game changed when Italy won the World Cup, playing the way Italy played, you know, international football, international tournaments, you know, it changed. Italy's victory changed the way international football was played forever in terms of winning major competitions. But it is an anomaly. And I had a discussion, a friend of mine called Aidan, who work quite closely with, you know, and he said, you know, you always get excited by Brazil, but they always let you down. And, you know, realistically, you kind of need to like let them go almost and, you know, come to terms with the fact that 82 and 70 probably were anomalies. It's not the norm, but yeah, such were the standards and such were the hopes of generations that saw those sides that you couldn't help. And it must be the same with the Dutch. You know, if you watched the Dutch of 74 and arguably 78, you must constantly expect the Dutch to replicate that and to show that, but it's never going to happen.
And the Dutch in 2010, that was arguably their Brazil in 74 moment. It was just, it was brutal.
It was horrific. Yeah, it was. And I always think that's so, it's such a sad, I think football's brilliant. I think it's such a great game and it is capable of such beauty. And when it's almost abused in such a way, it sort of hurts. But when it's abused by teams who don't do that or shouldn't do that and don't have a reputation for that, it's almost like it hurts a bit more, which is unfair on the Dutch and the Brazilians. But it's kind of their fault because they set the standard for beauty. So if you're going to set those standards, it's your fault if you can't keep up with it.
Dunga made a remark around 94, or made some retort at the 82 side. And I tried to go back through the book, but I couldn't find it. But, you know, paraphrase, and I think the gist of it was they were losers. And, you know, we won. Now, I actually, he was my favourite player of that Brazil team. I think he was an underrated player, Dunga, really better on the ball than he was credited for. I wonder if he was that kind of player missing from the 82 side?
Yeah, you see, this is the thing when you look at sort of modern day football and you try and apply it to yesteryear, if you like, or you try and apply it to moments or games, and you think, oh, if only they had that, or if only so-and-so was fit. And now, you know, in international football, there's always going to be a place for that person who protects the back four or back three, you know, however it's done, there's always now going to be a place for that. Italy didn't necessarily play with players who protected the back four. They played with an absolutely brutal back four. But to me, Dunga wins the World Cup and is the captain. And, you know, it's the ultimate accolade. You know, so few people only 18 people have ever lifted the Men's World Cup, you know, in history. And so that should be enough. But I think I can't decide if it's resentment on his part because he's still not recognised or revered in a way that 80, like Socrates, you know, Socrates was the captain of 82, and you think of the reverence that Socrates is held in. Granted, you know, his politics and so on comes with that and his story, but I don't understand, but that's because I'm not a professional footballer, how a World Cup winner can be bitter enough to make a comment about a team that don't win. I really struggle with it, but I've never won a World Cup, so maybe I would be different, but I would like to think that I wouldn't be, and part of it, again, almost enhances the myth of this side, that actually this side was so iconic that actually the World Cup winning captain resents them for not winning it. It seems incredulous, but it just goes to reinforce the myth that exists around this team.
In writing the book, did you learn anything about this side that surprised you?
Not so much that surprised me. I was surprised by Telly Santana as an individual and as a character. He surprised me. I didn't know a lot about him, but he wasn't how I imagined him to be. He wasn't how I imagined when the players spoke about him. He wasn't how I imagined him to be. I got a new appreciation, like we said, about Perez, Serginho, the side in general, from watching those games over and over and over and over again, you know, and really almost overanalyzing in minute detail what happened in those games and what went well and what didn't go well. So I learned more about the performances, but in terms of the team, in terms of how I remember them, in terms of how they made me feel, it delights me that it was still exactly the same. It hadn't changed in the slightest. It hadn't diminished. Yes, the game is slower than you remember, but it's a product of its time. You know, today's game will look slower in 40 years' time as well, I have no doubt. But yeah, the best part about it was exactly how I remembered it, and it still makes me feel how it did as a 10-year-old. It's not diminished in any way, shape or form, which was a worry going into this, that, look, you're going to have to forensically examine this team. Will it lose this mythical status, if you like? Will it lose this naivety that you had for it as a child once you start looking at it as an adult in such detail that you're going to have to? But it really didn't, which was a relief because I was worried.
And finally, I mean, this interview being a case in point, we've talked about Brazil 82. We've mentioned the Dutch in 74 a couple of times, and I suppose less so simply because it preceded the football on TV age, Hungary 54. Why are we so enamoured by glorious failure? Is that a British thing, or is that just a football thing in general, that we love these teams? Why do we love Brazil 82? Why do we love the Dutch in 74? They stay in the memory often longer than the winners.
I absolutely agree. And again, same guy I was talking about, Aidan. You know, he's another one that we talk about this quite often, about how it's very rare that the right team win a major tournament. It's very rare that a tournament goes and you look at the winners and go, yeah, best team by a mile, the right winners, well done. You can find in most tournaments, oh, if only they'd won it, or if only they'd done that. I think as it's human nature to be obsessed with what could have been, what might have been. You know, it seems to be in our DNA to always look at strands and, you know, how would things be different? What if this had happened? What if that had happened? But I also think deep down, football, real football fans, real fans of football are actually very romantic people. And I think a lot of it comes from that. I think the romance of almost, I suppose it's almost like unrequited love or lost love. It, you know, it almost has a feel of that. It has a feel of people being wronged. You know, that's not how the world should be. It's not fair. You know, you want to be an advocate for those sides. You want fairness to play out. You want to replay the Italy game, or you want to play the finals against West Germany that Hungary and the Dutch both lose. You know, it's almost in our human nature to right wrongs. And because you can't, you become obsessed with it and you can't let it go. You know, you can't think, oh, yeah, they were unlucky, never mind. It becomes an obsession more so than teams that actually win it or why they won it.
It's been a brilliant 100 minutes talking to a man from Scarborough tonight who looks more Spanish than I do about...
Yeah, that's what I get told.
About this extraordinary team that captivated us as boys. And it's, you know, it certainly left its mark on you. And I was able to maybe understand what I was watching as a boy that summer much better for reading your book. So thank you for your time, Stuart. Tell us where people can find your book. Tell us where they can find you on social media. Tell them about the brilliant Heavyweight Football podcast that you present to, and just in general, where they can find your work.
I tend to hang out on Twitter as the only real social media that I use. It's it's Loxley Misty, which is LOXLEYMISTY 44. When I first set up on social media, I was not a football writer. I was none of the things that I am now. And it was two of my children's names and the door number. Just that was where that came
that works.
From. Yep, that works. And until now, when people go, I can't find you. And you go, that's because you're not looking for my children's names and my door number. So that's where I am on Twitter. In terms of the book, the book's, you know, available on the big, large corporate capitalist sites like Amazon. It's also available in independent bookstores, available in Waterstones, Pitch Publishing, who are the publishers for it. They have copies of it as well, which are a fantastic publishing company and great to work with. These Football Times is, I shall forever be grateful to the guys there. Certainly Omar, who's the editor, is an incredible guy for giving people a platform to write on, a platform to just express whatever it is you want about the game of football. And that's kind of where I got lucky. You know, these Football Times will take pretty much any story from any era about any team, any player, any game. And if you can make it interesting enough, Omar will promote it for you and put it out there. And so, you know, I was lucky enough to start writing for those about 4 years ago. And then from there, there's four of us, really good. Well, there's more than four, but certainly Gary Thacker, Stephen Scragg and Aidan Williams, the four of us run the podcast, which I have the immense fortune to host quite a few of the sort of series and episodes that we do, because the three guys, their knowledge is about the game is just phenomenal. And I get the best part of just asking whatever pops into my head at the time because I want to know about something. And 99% of the time, they are incredibly obliging and forgiving for the questions that we've not planned or written down or said we're going to talk about, but they just pop in. So yeah, you know, these Football Times, it has online articles, it has bi-monthly magazines, it has podcast series, again, about the most, not necessarily obscure, but certainly less mainstream. But again, as we said at the end, for people who love the game or football romantics or people who like to wallow in nostalgia, it's, and like yourself, you know, and this podcast, it taps right into that demographic who just love the game for what it is.
How do you follow up this book? Can you follow up this book?
Well, yes. And yes, I am, is the short answer. It's actually an extension of what's just been written. So it's now a look at, the next book is now a look at that entire 82 tournament. So It's the entire tournament start to finish. It's not another focus on Brazil. That's not it. That's not what this is now. It's, for me, and you know, you might agree as well, something that I find fascinating is that most people's first World Cup ends up being their favourite, no matter how good or bad it is. The 82 World Cup for me will always be the greatest World Cup. And it probably isn't. But for me, it is. And I would like to think that I can convince people who it isn't their favourite that it's worth a look at. But when you actually step up, when I step away from the Brazil side and look at the tournament, you know, and it has so many incidents. You know, the Falklands conflict sits in the right from game one. You have the Austria-West Germany game that is an absolute farce. You have Cameroon unbeaten going home. You have the Kuwait side who are asked to walk off because of the phantom was then walked back on again. You have Harald Schumacher and the challenge of that. Those two, you know, incredible, or that epic semi-final, sorry, between France and West Germany. It's just a tournament that is so rich with stories. To me, and maybe Mexico 86 as well, they're probably the last two World Cups where it has not necessarily an amateur feel, but it has a feel where it's not corporate, it's not capitalist. Once you hit Italian 90, it becomes about the image and the brand, whereas 82 and 86 is still about the football, it's still about the stories, it's still about the different narratives that run through the tournaments that some people, you know, will have forgotten about, some people might never have known, some people might know a lot about. But it's a book about, again, probably my 10-year-old perspective will be there, because it's about why is our first World Cup usually the best, and why is it so important to us, and why do we cling on to it when there have probably been better ones since, but you almost refuse to acknowledge that. And then from there, it is almost like a case for the defence of the 1982 World Cup tournament as a whole, and why it's so great.
Full time. Thank you to Stuart Horsfield. Links to Stuart's Twitter and book will be available in the show notes too. Stuart's new book that he was referring to there at the end of the show, España 82, A Hazy Shade of Summer, it is due out. I think it was meant to be out this month, so its release is imminent, so keep a lookout for that. It's published also, once again, by Pitch Publishing, and I'm sure will be available in all the usual places. Just keep an eye out for it. I'll reiterate again, I was a big fan of those round-robin group stages of the 74, 78 and 82 World Cups. I think personally the so-called drama of penalties, I just think it's so old now. We've been watching them now for the last 40 or so years. I just think it's a poor way of deciding the big tournaments. You know there's always going to be a fall guy at the end, and you can often guess who it is. I still haven't forgotten Euro 96. Gareth Southgate, as soon as he stepped up, I thought, that's the nicest guy in the England team. That's the guy that's going to miss, and he missed. But at the same time, listening to Stuart talking about that second round group stage in 82 and Brazil's huge misfortune in both Italy and Argentina both failing to win their groups, leaving Brazil having to face them both before the semi-final stage. Something like that doesn't do the round-robin group stage any favours. And, of course, that is the last time we saw those second-round round-robin group stages in play. Personally, I do miss them. I just think that league system, that league format, the last man standing element to it, it's a better way of deciding the greatest team. And I think it's an important thing, because it's only once every 4 years, the World Cup. Although, I mean, the World Cup, the European Championships, they've lost so much now because it's just so hard not to qualify for these tournaments. For instance, let's take the Welsh team to give you an example where they now sail. So this Welsh team has now qualified for three international tournaments after however many decades not qualifying for the finals of a major tournament. Yes, they've qualified because it's easier to qualify now. That's not to say they're not good enough to qualify. It's not to say they never were good enough to qualify. I think, when was it, a couple of weeks ago or last week, or the Leighton James episode, the Welsh team of the mid-70s that failed to qualify for 78, the overlooked early 80s side that came close to qualifying for Spain 82, those sides were good enough to grace major international tournaments, but it was only 16 teams in those days, 24 teams in the case of 82, of course, which is the tournament we're talking about or were talking about this week. Stuart has made me question that round robin second round stage, because certainly Brazil's early exit did cost an otherwise brilliant tournament something that year. That's it for this week. The podcast can be followed on both Twitter and Instagram at Shorts Were Short. Follow the show on Facebook when Shorts Were Short 2023. Just if you want to join the group page, please do. There are people posting regularly on there now. It seems to be mainly from Belgium. I think that seems to be a bit of a stronghold in terms of listeners for the show, and which always puts me in mind of one of my favourite bands of the late 80s, Swing Out Sister, who were absolutely massive in Japan, but not that big anywhere else. The only criteria for posting in that group is, of course, that the shorts should be short. That is our historical window. The show is also on Threads at Shorts Were Short. If you want to drop me an email, you can get me shortswereshort@1607westegg.com. Lee, Giles, Gordon, I still owe you emails. I'm still working on that. Please bear with me. Support the show at Ko-Fi. I always say Ko-Fi. It's coffee.com, Kilo Oscar, -foxtrotindia.com /Daniel Rivers Tires, and everything comes back into the work. All these links are available in the show notes. Thank you for your time. I've been Daniel Rivers Tires, and this has been When Shorts Were Short. If the shorts weren't short, we don't talk about it.